Hello and welcome to another Inside Education podcast. On today's programme, I'm joined by Dr. Christian Dalavas from the University of Notre Dame in Indiana in the United States to talk about school leadership and Catholic schools in the United States. Christian Dalavas is a former middle school and high school teacher of English and theatre arts who taught in the United States and in Bangladesh. Currently, he works at the Alliance for Catholic Education at the University of Notre Dame, where he is director of the Notre Dame ACE Academies. That's a partnership initiative designed to increase access to high-quality educational opportunities for disadvantaged children by promoting engagement between the university and individual urban Catholic schools. Christian has specific responsibility in the areas of school leadership and school culture, and he works with teachers, pastors, and principals. He has also supported beginning teachers in the United States and developed international teaching opportunities for them in Ireland and Chile. He attended the University of Michigan, where he earned a joint PhD in English and Education. You're welcome to Inside Education, Christian. Could you begin by telling me a little bit about the work that you did in preparing opportunities for beginning teachers to work in Ireland?
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity to do this. I taught in ACE in Mississippi. ACE is the Alliance for Catholic Education. It's a program at the University of Notre Dame that prepares beginning teachers. When I finished college, I taught for 2 years in Mississippi, and then through ACE, taught in Bangladesh for a year, as you mentioned. After that, I came back to the university to work on the ACE staff for a while, and my job was to support beginning teachers who were teaching in their first and second year in Catholic schools in the southeastern United States mostly. And then another part of my responsibilities was to prepare and kind of create some opportunities for our graduates to continue doing service in other places. So much like the program I did where I taught in Bangladesh at a school called Notre Dame College that's run by the Congregation of Holy Cross, we set up a similar teaching program in Dublin, and we set up one in Santiago, Chile as well.
And how many teachers did you send to Ireland?
We sent four a year for a few years, and they would kind of split their time. They spent some time at St. Pat's, where they were working with young student teachers, and then they also spent time in Tala, where they were working with in schools that serve a disadvantaged community.
And was the fact that they wouldn't have had Irish, was that a problem for them?
It was a problem for them. They weren't able to be full-time teachers. They were more like teachers' aides, and they assisted the teachers in the classrooms, but they weren't able to have their own classes.
And you yourself, Christian, taught English and theatre arts to middle and high school students. What was that experience like?
It was tough. I taught in a 7th through 12th grade school in Biloxi, Mississippi, right on the coast, not far from New Orleans. The school I taught at actually was destroyed by Hurricane Katrina a few years after I completed my service there. But the school was, like I said, 7th through 12th grade, so 12-year-olds through high school seniors. And we had a real wide range of kids in the school, from low income to high income, a pretty diverse school. I taught middle school language arts, so I was the grammar teacher, and I also taught literature, and then had the opportunity to teach theater my second year in the high school. But it was a good experience. I was a product of Catholic schools myself, and this was, for me, an opportunity to do two things. One, to do a service program and to kind of give back to the system of schools that I felt had given me so much. And two, it was an opportunity to see if teaching was for me. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be a teacher after college, and this was kind of a 2-year trial period to see if education was where my vocation was.
Now, you said that you were a product of Catholic schools yourself. So what got you first interested in Catholic schools in the United States?
I was kind of born into it in some ways. I grew up, as I said, went to a Catholic elementary school, a Catholic high school, a Catholic university. My mom was the secretary at the Catholic school that I attended in St. Louis in Missouri. And, you know, through Notre Dame's ACE program, I had the chance to get back into Catholic schools on the other side of the desk, and took the chance. And like I said, it was a 2-year kind of test run, and obviously, I'm still in it, so it got its hooks into me.
And if we go back then to look back at a historical view of Catholic schools in the United States, why were they first established here?
Mm-hmm. So this is something that I came to really enjoy studying at the University of Michigan when I was studying for a PhD. I I had spent all this time working for ACE supporting beginning teachers in the southeastern United States, and part of that job involved me going to about 40 or 50 different schools every semester, Catholic schools in Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Tennessee, Kansas, really kind of all over. And as a result of being in all those different kinds of schools, I started to develop a lot of questions about kind of why kids were having different experiences in different schools, and how teachers were prepared to work with kids who came from backgrounds different from their own. At Michigan, I really dug into the history of urban education first, and what I learned was that the Catholic schools in the United States were really established as an immigrant response to a pretty hostile public school environment at the time. So in the early 19th century, in places like New York and Philadelphia and Boston, the Catholic communities were largely immigrant, largely Irish, and largely not well respected. In the public schools at the time, the kids were really encouraged to kind of shed their ethnic identity as quickly as possible and to assimilate and Americanize. And there was a pretty overt religious curriculum in the public schools. It was kind of a non-denominational Protestant curriculum. But this notion that we have today of the separation of church and state and education, just it wasn't something anyone thought of 200 years ago. That everyone pretty much agreed that religion should be part of education. The problem arose when we wound up having a critical mass of people who didn't share the same religion as everyone else. And so the Catholic immigrant communities really fought for their right to have their own schools. And the first Archbishop of New York, John Hughes, was the first American Catholic bishop to really fight for a parent's right to choose the best school for their child. And ultimately, he lost that fight. The state ruled in favor of the public schools, but the public schools didn't really win either. The public schools were stripped of all of their religious curriculum, and they were forced to kind of become totally secularized.
So this is the beginning of the 1800s, is that
1840s,
right?
1840s, yeah.
Okay, so this is when the separation of church and state then really began in the 1840s.
Right. So that's when the Archbishop of New York essentially sued the state for funding for Catholic schools, because the Catholic children who were attending public schools were being forced to read the King James Bible. They were being forced to read textbooks that were very harshly critical of immigrant communities, and the Irish in particular. And there just really wasn't a welcome atmosphere for them. They were in some ways trying to strip their ethnic identity, and parents feared their faith was being stripped from them as well. And so the Archbishop really fought for the right to use public funding to support education. When he lost that fight, he kind of doubled down efforts to build our own system, to really build a parallel private school system. And what's interesting is that the United States is in some ways unique in that it has a parallel system of private schools running alongside public schools. No other country in the world really has that.
I want to find out a little bit more about that, but just one thing I want to just backtrack a little bit on was that one of the things I heard once was that the reason public schools were established in the United States in the first place was to civilize immigrants, and particularly Irish immigrants, who were coming speaking a strange language, and who, because they had come away from home, they, you know, even though they might have been good living at home, when they arrived in the United States, they were anything but. And there was problems with alcohol and so on. And that the public schools were actually established partly for the Irish. Is that true?
I think there, you know, historians will, I think, have some arguments about whether that's true or not. I think that there are some who would argue that the public schools were kind of designed to civilize a workforce and to teach values like promptness and accountability and kind of how to be a good productive worker. That's certainly one kind of interpretation of U.S. educational history. I think that it probably wasn't quite so clear-cut as that. I don't think that kind of the captains of industry created schools with the explicit purpose of churning out kind of robotic workers, but I think that that is one of the results. I think that that's one of the consequences of the system that, that did emerge.
And how far back do public schools go in the United States?
They go back far. I don't know when the first public schools were. I know that it was in the early 1800s that kind of public school societies started to coalesce to really to make schooling more formalized. But it really kind of emerged differently in different places.
Okay, so if you bring us forward then to the Archbishop, was it of New York?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he lost the court case, but then he decided to establish a parallel system of private Catholic schools.
Right.
And how did he fund them? And how did they grow from New York?
Yeah, so the one thing to clarify, he didn't just create a new system of schools. The schools already existed, so the Catholic schools kind of emerged organically as the public schools did side by side. The Archbishop was really just trying to get a slice of the funding that was going to the public schools for the Catholic schools. When that failed, he really kind of mobilized folks to double down on the effort to grow the school system and to ensure that there would be a Catholic school for every Catholic child. It grew differently in different cities, largely in response to the different ethnic groups that settled in those places. So in a city like Chicago, which was a major landing point for a lot of different immigrant groups from Europe, the bishops were very kind of loose in their in that they let the different immigrant groups start their own parishes and their own schools. And in, say, the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago, for example, you could find probably 17 or 20 different Catholic churches and schools. Some of them almost right across the street from each other, but you know, one would be for Poles, one would be for Germans, one would be for Czechs, one would be for Lithuanians, and so you would, in some cities like that where you had a really diverse kind of ethnic immigrant population, you would see a kind of explosion of Catholic schools that were very specifically focused around a cultural group. Other cities, you didn't see that as much, and some of the ethnic groups didn't take to starting their own schools as much as others did. The Italians, for example, didn't start schools in the same numbers as the Poles or the Germans. The Poles and Germans probably were the most aggressive in terms of building schools. And you wound up with situations like in Chicago, you had in Pilsen, inside one geographic parish, you would have a second church, which was just for Poles, and then that church would get so big they would need a third church, which was also for Poles. So in a span of maybe 8 square blocks, you would have 3 very large parishes with 3 very full schools right around this. And this would be from the time period of about 1880s to 1920s. And now, of course, those schools, many of them are closed, but most of them in Pilsen, for example, are full of newly arrived immigrants, mostly from Mexico and Latin America.
So it sounds, though, as if it could be potentially quite divisive if you have every immigrant group sticking to their own community, pretty much, in terms of where they're learning, where they're living, and where they're worshiping.
Yes, and there was a bitter fight among the bishops at the time in the 1880s. The American bishops were really divided. On the one side, led by Archbishop John Ireland from St. Paul in Minnesota, Archbishop Ireland really pushed for Catholics in the United States to Americanize so that they could assimilate and gain power that way. And his hope was that Catholics, American Catholics, would go to the public schools and kind of, you know, work their way into power by assimilating. Others, like the bishops in Chicago and others in other ethnic enclaves, were more interested in letting the immigrant groups maintain their cultural identities, to maintain their language, maintain the faith of their homelands, because there was this fear that culture and language and faith were all kind of wrapped up in each other. And so if you insist that children aren't allowed to, for example, in schools in Chicago, if you insist that kids aren't allowed to pray in Polish, the language that their mother taught them to pray in, that they would somehow fall away from their faith if they were fell away from their language. And so there was a bit of a fight among the bishops, and it was taken all the way to the Vatican, and ultimately was determined that the immigrant groups should be allowed to have their own parishes, their own ethnic parishes. In the end, John Ireland lost that battle. while he was still alive, although years later that became his kind of vision of American Catholic schools became what we have today, which is a much more broadly kind of assimilated type of school than what he would have what he was kind of fighting against 100 years ago.
And before we go on to the schools of today, do you know if any Irish established schools, or did they tend to move into schools that had been established by other communities?
No, they did. They absolutely did establish schools. And so, for example, the school, the neighborhood in Chicago that I mentioned, Pilsen, the Irish parish was the geographic parish. So then it was the Poles and Czechs and Lithuanians who started their own parishes within parishes. But the Irish started schools in huge numbers as well.
So if we move on then to today, first of all, are Catholic schools in the United States, are they largely an urban phenomenon, or do you find Catholic schools in kind of country areas or in rural areas?
They are an urban phenomenon in some ways, partly because they were established by immigrant communities who largely settled in urban areas. You don't find a lot of Catholic schools in rural areas in the United States. They are mostly urban, some and then suburban as well. But they really are kind of concentrated in our cities.
Okay, and how would you characterize their student communities today?
They've really changed over the last 50 years, probably. As immigrant communities in American cities experience social mobility and intergenerational kind of mobility, and as white flight took effect in some of the urban areas, you see that a lot of these immigrant groups have moved out to the suburbs, and they started Catholic schools in the suburbs as well, but they left a lot of empty buildings behind. And those buildings in a lot of places are now filled with newly arrived immigrants, as I said earlier, mostly from Latin America. In some places, they're filled with African Americans who are often not Catholic, but attend Catholic schools. And so we see a much more diverse population of students in Catholic schools today, whereas 100 years ago, it would have been a largely, almost exclusively European community and demographic. Today, we see about 30% of the kids in Catholic schools are from a minority group. And we see about 15 to 20% are not Catholic. And so there's kind of an increasing number of families that are choosing to send their children to Catholic school, even though they are not themselves Catholic.
I'm partly smiling when you say that, because just earlier today, the Minister for Education in Ireland has been complaining that Catholic schools in Ireland need to become more inclusive. So how do these schools who have substantial non-Catholic populations, how do they manage to be inclusive?
It's a challenge in some ways, because the Catholic schools were established as kind of a means of evangelizing the next generation, as well as educating them. And the goal really has become, and this has been a shift, I think, in the last 40 or 50 years, the goal really has shifted from kind of transmitting the faith towards a sort of social justice mission in some way. So it's often said of non-Catholic kids in Catholic schools, we don't educate them because they're Catholic, we educate them because we're Catholic. And the idea is that we transmit the values of our faith, and we transmit the benefits of, or we offer kids the benefits of a faith-based community, and the values and character formation that come with that. And it's not as important to us that the kids be Catholic as much as it's important to us that we give them a great educational opportunity in a community in which their faith formation can flourish.
And do they attend classes in Catholic instruction, for example?
They do. They would. Do. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Because one of the things that the minister in Ireland was saying, that Catholic education needs to take place either at the beginning of the day or the end of the day, mm-hmm. so that students who don't want to be there can elect not to be there.
Sure. And the difference here would be that the students who don't want to be there wouldn't be there. So Catholic schools are entirely voluntary, and parents typically have to pay tuition to send their kids to a Catholic school. So when we do find non-Catholic families in Catholic schools, it's often because the family has made a sacrifice, because they want them in that school, because they want those values transmitted, because they want that instruction. And while some struggle to understand how a family of one faith could make sacrifices to send their children to a school where they learn a different faith. The best kind of description I've seen of this is from a researcher named Jackie Jordan Irvine, who is an African American scholar of education who attended Catholic schools and wrote edited a great book called "Growing Up African American in Catholic Schools," and she talks about how there was more cultural congruence with the faith than there was cultural kind of
dissonance.
Yeah. So the idea was that while the kind of dogma that was taught was different, the kind of culture of the faith was very much reflective of the culture of the faith of her home and the church that she and her family worshiped in. And I think that really captures why a lot of parents would make the sacrifice to pay tuition to send their children to a school, even if they're not of the same faith.
And apart from the faith, although obviously that is going to be part of the answer to this question, but how are Catholic schools similar to or different from public schools in the United States?
You know, in some ways, they certainly would look and feel very similar in terms of kind of the rhythm of the day, the schedule, the curriculum our Catholic schools are kind of held to the same state standards that public schools are. We find that there are a couple of key differences. One, of course, is the faith aspect and the there's a religious education component to it. There's also kind of an underlying kind of school culture that is really rooted in the faith that, in many schools would really make the school a different place fundamentally than a place that isn't rooted in that culture. So the idea is that there are certain kind of shared beliefs that the teachers in the building all kind of buy into, and they kind of enjoy a shared purpose for being in the school, and that in good schools would kind of leak into everything that happens in the school, from the discipline policy to the curriculum. The ways in which the Catholic schools would be different from public schools is that there would be, in Catholic schools, you'd find kind of an explicit engagement with questions of faith. You'd find explicit engagement with moral issues and kind of lively discussion and conversation around moral issues and questions that are rooted in faith, social issues and political issues even, that would be rooted in faith. And I think that another thing that you would find that would be different from public schools is, in some ways is ironically part of why public Catholic schools have been effective, is that they don't offer as many courses or they don't offer as many kind of paths. So there's no vocational track in Catholic schools. And that's in some ways because we've never been able to afford to offer that many. But the result is that everybody who goes to a Catholic school takes a core academic curriculum. And some researchers have hypothesized that that's part of what makes Catholic schools more effective, especially for low-income communities, because often kids in public schools in low-income communities will find themselves in vocational tracks that don't provide a path to college, whereas the Catholic schools only have one track, and there's really no other options.
And Catholic schools generally have come out quite well in any comparative studies between Catholic schools and public schools in terms of students' achievement.
That's right, yeah. So since the early 1980s, researchers have been studying what they call the Catholic school advantage, really trying to determine the extent to which children who attend Catholic schools enjoy an academic advantage over their peers who don't, especially when controlling for different socioeconomic indicators. And there is a good kind of a large and growing body of research to suggest that Catholic schools are especially effective for what one researcher called the multiply disadvantaged kids, who are poor, minority, displaced, or marginalized, immigrant, the people who come from, have kind of the deck stacked against them in a way.
Are students prepared for making their sacraments in Catholic schools?
They often are. Usually in second grade, students will be prepared for First Communion and First Reconciliation. That is one area, obviously, in which non-Catholic students in a Catholic school would not participate in that. But yeah, and then depending on the location, some places it's eighth grade, other places it's in high school, they prepare for confirmation.
And how is that managed on a practical basis then? If some students are not taking part, do they do something different or do they go to another class?
You know, it's going to vary by school, but and some schools that would serve, for example, a school that would serve a largely non-Catholic population, they would do their sacramental preparation in an after-school program typically. But if most of the kids are receiving the sacraments, then often that will take place during the school day, and students will participate in that class. They just obviously won't. Nobody's forcing any sacraments on anybody.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that some parents, that parents have to pay to send their child to a Catholic school. Are they completely self-funding like that, or how does funding work for Catholic schools?
They are. Catholic school funding is one of our big problems. It's one of our big challenges facing American Catholic schools. As one of the only nations in the world that doesn't provide federal support for faith-based schools. We wind up with a really wide range of kind of financial pictures in Catholic schools. So you would, in your kind of more upscale or suburban schools that are serving kind of middle and upper middle class and upper class families, you would find a tuition model where tuition covers the cost to educate every kid. In urban areas and in schools that serve low income communities, we find that the cost to educate children far exceeds families' capacity to pay. For example, some schools that we work with in Tucson, Arizona, the cost to educate this year is about $5,100, per student per year, which is very low. But it's very low compared to national averages. But it's really high for families who are living on the margins, and it's out of reach for most families. It's in some places parishes subsidize schooling, and other places dioceses do, but often we're finding more and more parishes and dioceses can't afford to do that either. And this is where we're, you know, the legacy of the sisters who founded these schools, the religious women who founded these schools, is really becoming difficult for us, because as the sisters leave the schools and retire, and they're not being replaced by more sisters who are taking a vow of poverty, we're finding we have to pay lay people a fair wage and a competitive wage to get the best teachers. And it's just, so the cost of Catholic education has kind of skyrocketed because there was this kind of artificial labor subsidy that the sisters had been supplying for so long.
And it was mainly teaching sisters who had set up and run the schools since they were set up?
Largely, yeah. So they were largely staffed by teaching sisters. So pastors would contract with the religious community, and they would lead and staff the school.
Okay.
And we've gone from, you know, in the 1960s, about 2/3 of all Catholic school teachers were religious men and women. Today, it's under 4%, and half of them are over the age of 70. So we're very quickly finding ourselves in a position where that's just not. There isn't a meaningful presence of religious men and women in our schools anymore, unfortunately.
Okay. And how are Catholic schools held accountable for the quality of learning in them? I mean, do you have, like, say, for example, in Ireland, we have the Department of Education sends around inspectors to schools. Mm-hmm. What happens for Catholic schools because it's a private sector?
Right. It's different in different states. So here in Indiana, every child in the state takes a test called the I-STEP. It's a math and reading and skills test. And those scores are published in the newspaper for Catholic schools and public schools alike. In other states, it's a little more difficult. It just depends on the state laws and around accountability. But in Arizona, for example, where we work with some schools, parents really only know what the schools tell them, and parents really have to do a lot of their own homework to find out more about the schools. There are accrediting agencies that do routine visits, and they kind of do a comprehensive assessment of schools and offer accreditation, and that's an important kind of way in which Catholic schools are held accountable. But ultimately, they're held accountable by parents, who it's a market. And parents, if the school isn't good, parents will move their kids to another school. And parents really kind of vote with their feet in Catholic schools. And that's really the main kind of lever of accountability that we see.
Yeah. What other churches, if any, have substantial numbers of schools in the United States?
The Lutherans have a very robust presence, especially there's a number of Midwestern cities. Milwaukee is the one that jumps to mind, where there are some really incredible Lutheran schools, and there's a pretty strong network of them. There are some other religious groups that have their own schools. There are a smaller number of Jewish day schools and they call them day schools to differentiate from the evening or weekend schools that would be just kind of for religious education. And then there are a small but growing number of Muslim schools in the United States, but that's still a pretty small number.
Okay. You're clearly a fan and a supporter of Catholic schools, and I think you've given a good case for that. Do you worry in an era of increasing secularism that church schools, or Catholic schools in particular, could be seen as an anachronism in society today?
Yeah, I don't think I worry about it as much as I in some ways appreciate it. I think that in some ways there's a challenge for an institution that is as old as the church and as old as Catholic education to constantly remain relevant, but I don't see any evidence, and the schools that we're partnering with in particular, I see lots of evidence that parents see us as increasingly relevant, that in a culture that is kind of increasingly secular, families that have deep roots in their faith really value an education that's rooted in the faith. And this is where I think in some ways that kind of anachronistic dimension to a faith-based school could create could be a benefit. It could be an advantage. I think about theories of how kids learn around that are really rooted in culture, and this is kind of an increasingly large and important area of educational research around what's called culturally responsive pedagogy, or sometimes culturally relevant pedagogy. But the idea is basically that learning is a social behavior, and that because of that, it's fundamentally cultural, and that kids from different cultures learn in different ways, and that good teachers kind of ground their lessons and their instruction and their curriculum in the cultures of the children they serve. And in some ways, this is a new kind of set of theories in the education world that really kind of began in the mid-1990s, and in recent years have become a really big part of kind of national educational conferences and things. But it's really kind of what Catholic schools have been doing for 200 years, really rooting the education in the faith and the culture and the language of the family. I think in some ways when we have access in our classrooms to talk about the religious dimension of culture, that gives us an advantage. It gives our teachers an advantage in educating the children. If culture is an important part of education, and religion certainly an important part of culture, then I think we have an opportunity to educate kids in ways that you can't in secular schools.
And culturally responsive pedagogy, that wasn't developed for Catholic schools. That's a broader term. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Idea? So one great source on this is a book called The Dream Keepers by Gloria Ladson Billings, who's a professor at Wisconsin. And what Ladson Billings did is she recognized that the educational research data suggests that African-American children in the United States don't often do well in school, or they often lag behind. There's an achievement gap between their performance and other groups' performance. But anecdotally, she knew lots of people whose African-American children were doing quite well in school. And so she sought out to kind of identify bright spots and study them. And so she found a dozen or so teachers who were teachers of African American children who were kind of exceptionally high performing. The kids were performing at very high levels in these teachers' classrooms, and she followed the teachers and really studied them to determine kind of what they had, whether they had anything in common that could be effective. And what she found was that they really kind of embraced three core tenets. One is that they had high expectations for academic achievement. The second is that they fostered cultural competence, meaning they centralized culture in the classroom, and they helped kids to kind of know their own culture, but also kind of use their own culture to achieve in the classroom. And then third, they fostered a sense of sociopolitical consciousness, which means that they really tackled issues of culture and race and discrimination and kind of the political and social issues that that kids face in their everyday lives, especially minority kids from low-income families. And they addressed those explicitly. And in their classrooms, there was kind of the space for engaging in those kinds of conversations. And so this has kind of developed, Ladson and Billings called it culturally relevant pedagogy. Others have referred to as culturally responsive pedagogy. But this has really kind of developed into an approach that is becoming increasingly recognized as a useful and an effective way of strengthening educational achievement, especially when the culture of the teachers and the students aren't the same. So there's a researcher at the University of Washington named Geneva Gay who says when the culture of the students and the teachers don't line up, someone misses out, and invariably it's the students. Culturally responsive pedagogy is when the teacher takes it on him or herself to kind of address that in a very explicit way.
You have also done research on urban schools. I suppose we would refer to urban schools as schools that serve areas traditionally associated with disadvantage. But you looked at high-performing disadvantaged or urban schools. What makes such schools high-performing?
So I had a really fascinating opportunity to spend a year visiting high-performing schools that serve low-income communities. And what I found is that there is kind of something that they all have in common, and it's really that they all have a very strong, positive, intentional school culture. And by that I mean that the beliefs, the practices, the values, the shared purpose, that all of those kind of cultural elements were explicitly articulated, and that everything that happened in the school was designed to reflect those beliefs. So to give you an example of one, there's a network of charter schools in the United States called the Knowledge is Power Program Schools, or KIPP schools. They're probably the largest charter school franchise in the country, and one of the most successful. And, you know, they articulate the beliefs that are at the core of their schools, and the values that they hold up as kind of, in a sense, sacred, are to work hard and be nice. And it's that simple. And everything flows out of that. And every policy and procedure and operating norm, everything that happens during the day, from how kids turn in their papers in class to how they are treated when they have a discipline infraction, everything reflects those core beliefs to work hard and be nice. In our schools, we've kind of adopted a similar approach. We articulate that the root belief that's behind every one of our policies and procedures is that God is in all things, and that sacramental worldview informs everything from our discipline policy to how we deal with kids who are late for school to the uniform policy to, how we choose curriculum for math or reading class.
But if you take even go back, say, to the KIPP one of the work hard and be nice, it could easily be just kind of so easy to kind of to give pay lip service to it without actually, making it go deep and having it deeply affect all aspects of school. Mm-hmm. How does a school move from just words to actually putting something like that into action? Or like you say in Catholic schools, that God is in all things.
Mm-hmm. And that is the trick. That is the challenge. And what we have found, and what I think schools like the KIPP schools and other high performing schools have found, is that it really takes a lot of time and energy to explicitly articulate how those beliefs should be reflected in the everyday operating norms and procedures of the school. And then the adults in the building have to hold each other accountable for it. And so what we see in a KIPP school, for example, or in many Catholic schools and as well, are that if you set up those expectations that we're all going in KIPP schools to work hard, be nice, or I went to a Jesuit high school where I was told from the first day, you're here to be a man for others, right? And every adult in the building reinforces that every step of the way, and they make it very explicit. And some schools really kind of develop what they consider kind of, you know, a binder of operating norms where they explicitly articulate, this is why, or this is what we do, this is how we do it, and this is how it relates to our values. And so that kind of shared sense of purpose is really critical. And in some ways, it's what Catholic schools had when they were founded by religious communities. So a school founded by Jesuits was founded by a bunch of guys who went to the same school to learn how to be teachers. The same thing with the religious sisters. Whereas now in schools, you may have 10 or 12 teachers at your school who went to 10 or 12 different teacher training colleges and belong to 10 or 12 different parishes and have 10 or 12 different ideas about what it means to be Catholic or to be a Catholic school teacher. What we find the challenge in contemporary Catholic schools is to prepare principals to get everybody on the same page. So principals really bear the burden of building that culture and then holding the teachers accountable for it. And if the teachers aren't willing or able to reinforce those root beliefs, then it's not the school for them. And the principals have to really hold them accountable in meaningful ways.
Okay. And that brings us to the other area of research of yours, which is principalship and school leaders. What characteristics would you look for in a school principal?
I think the top characteristic that I look for is zeal. I think people, this idea that one would do whatever it takes to ensure that every child succeeds, no excuses, that kind of whatever it takes, no excuses attitude, and kind of zeal is critical. Basil Moreau is the founder of the Congregation of Holy Cross, which is the community that runs the University of Notre Dame here. And he defined zeal as that burning flame of desire to make God known, loved, and served. And in many ways, I think that is the top characteristic that will carry a school leader through the day. I think the others are kind of all related to zeal, but I think that strong principals have to have kind of unrelenting expectations for excellence. They have to believe that every child is capable of learning, and they have to have a growth mindset. They have to be persistent. They have to be service-oriented. They have to kind of be able to demonstrate love in a very real and concrete way as a school leader. And I think that they really have to be focused on building a culture of continuous improvement, that they have to just never be content that they have done what needs to be done, that there's always something, there's always ways to improve and get better.
And you lead the program here of preparing future principals and providing courses for serving principals. What are the components of the program that you offer?
We really focus on three areas: instructional leadership, executive management, and Catholic school culture. We've really believed that those are the three kind of domains in which a school leader in a Catholic school in the United States really has to be the really has to lead the community and create the community. They have to be strong in terms of having high expectations and knowing what it takes to hire and manage strong teachers for the classroom. They have to be able to kind of manage a budget and manage finances and do marketing and development work. And then they also have to be able to kind of build an authentically Catholic community and lead it as its spiritual leader. So it's a difficult job description, but those are the three areas that we really focus on.
And finally, Christian, how is being a principal of a Catholic school different to being principal in any other school, in any other public school?
I think that it's different in a couple of key ways. The main one being that, you know, when you're the principal of a Catholic school, you bring your faith to the community and you build a community around your vision of what an excellent school looks like. And so if your worldview is really grounded in this kind of sacramental vision that God is in all things and that every child is made in the image and likeness of God, then when you're doing your budget or when you're, you know, dealing with the copier company or, you know, the electric company, those interactions have a different sense of purpose because of your ultimate purpose. In Catholic schools, I think we really believe that what we're doing is in some ways a matter of life and death, and we really believe that we're not just kind of punching the clock and showing up from 9 to 5, but we're in the business of forming saints. And so because we're in the business of forming saints, you have to be willing to do whatever it takes to make sure each one of them succeeds. And I think that's what you'd find. And that's not to say that there aren't folks in public schools or other schools that aren't as devoted to their jobs or don't have the same kind of faith-based motivation. It's just that our principals can share that with students in the PA system every morning, which is, I think, a powerful way to lead a school.
Christian, thanks very much for talking to me.
Sure, thank you, Sean.
And my guest this week was Dr. Christian Dalavis from the University of Notre Dame. I'll be back with another podcast soon. You'll find almost 200 other Inside Education podcasts on the website seandelaney.com. For now, thank you for listening.